We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's the True Faith Newcastle United podcast. I'm Alex Hurst, and this is a podcast about the people that own Newcastle United, or 80% of it, the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, or the PIF, as it is better known. I don't know too much about them. They haven't said loads since they bought the club back in October 2021. But what they have done is achieved huge success on and off the pitch since they bought the club, alongside their fellow owners, Amanda Staveley, Murdoch Adusi, Jamie Rubin. So I thought I'd do a podcast and get three of the most well-researched and decorated academics I could find to talk about the subject of the PIF, who they are, where they came from, what they want to do, and where Newcastle United fit into that. If you like what we do, and if you like this podcast, the full interview, my full interviews with all three of our guests on our Patreon platform right now at £6.60 per month. Loads more of these True Faith podcasts, and it keeps this podcast going. We'd be really grateful if you could join us, and we've got loads of content building up to the new season, which I cannot wait for. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoy the show. Our first guest on the podcast this week is Professor Simon Chadwick, who is the Professor of Eurasian Sport and Director for the Centre for Eurasian Sport, working at the intersection of sport, business, politics and technology, particularly in a Eurasian context. Many thanks to Simon for his time, and I asked him essentially, who are the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia and what do they do?
So the Public Investment Fund is, in essence, the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia. A sovereign wealth fund is a state-established body that is charged with investing a country's wealth. So most obviously in Saudi Arabia, that wealth, probably as much as 70%, maybe even a little higher, Saudi Arabia's wealth is drawn from oil and gas. And so what the Public Investment Fund does is to take all of that money, and keep in mind this money has been made over decades and decades, and invest it in assets that the Saudi Arabian government wants to invest in. And those assets could be revenue generating assets. So a kind of traditional investment model, you spend a dollar to make $2 back kind of investment. Or alternatively, they make investments in projects that are of political or strategic significance to them.
Our next guest is Neil Quilliam, who is an associate fellow with the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House here in the United Kingdom. I spoke to Neil actually on this podcast back in summer of 2020, when the takeover was still being considered by the Premier League, and Neil was really informative then and has been again. And I started off by asking Neil that essentially no one that I know had ever heard of PIF before the Newcastle United takeover, yet now it seems to be in the news for all sorts of reasons, whether that's links with Uber, Disney, but most notably the Live Golf project, which PIF has started. I asked him how that had come about and whether this much higher profile for the PIF was intentional, and what that meant for both PIF and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
No, I mean, I think PIF sort of serves many purposes, but definitely, I think, I mean, it's a central plank of that is giving the Kingdom, you know, a much, much higher profile and a much more, say, positive profile. It's also tasked, along with the Ministry of Investment, but, you know, bringing foreign direct investment into the country. So by investing in Newcastle, that clearly raises its international profile. The same with, you know, with the LIV Golf Series, but the same with, you know, buying into Uber, buying into Disney, buying into Boeing. You've suddenly got this you know, massive brand recognition, which you would never have had before. The other Gulf states, you know, traditionally, I mean, the Qataris and the Emiratis and way back the Kuwaitis, you know, were much more prominent in this space. And I think the Saudis were quite late, you know, coming to the table, but they've done so with a big bang, you know, and the ambition is very much for PIF, you know, to be the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, you know, and the goal as has been set out by, you know, by the governor, Yasser Al-Rumayyan, is to have, you know, $2 trillion dollars worth of assets under, you know, under their belt by 2030, which is just a staggering amount of money.
And this change, you said, had been largely led by Mohammed bin Salman since he came to power. It seems quite radical in terms of a change of direction. You know, has he had much opposition to that? How has Saudi public feeling been surrounding the PIF and this extravagant expenditure of which you talk?
Yeah, I mean, I would say yes. He's been a driving force behind this. And as I sort of alluded to before, I think in wanting to, you know, help this transformation in the kingdom, basically the older, larger conglomerate businesses just weren't really fit for purpose. They had sort of emerged and grown up in an era, you know, where the states were enormously wealthy because of the oil revenues, but would hand out contracts, you know, with limited competition. So there was a certain, you know, relationship between state and very large companies, and a lot of it would be sewn up. Whereas I think he's seen PIF as being a bit of a disruptor in that. Being startup sounds strange when you've got such a huge budget, but, you know, like a startup coming into this space and just trying to sort of set fires absolutely everywhere. In terms of, you know, is there resistance, or there are no signs of resistance, but definitely, you know, amongst some of those more established, traditional, larger sort of family businesses, you know, there's a sense of frustration because previously, you know, they were the beneficiaries of large scale contracts and their companies would pick those up, but they're, you know, they're very much sort of, I guess, on the side now and are unable to compete with some of the businesses that PIF is bringing in externally. And certainly they can't compete with these businesses that PIF itself is establishing. So it's, I would see it, you know, it's not normal really for a sovereign wealth fund to be a disruptor, but in this sense, it's, you know, it's playing that role. It's establishment, but at the same time, it's somehow, you know, has a disruptive role.
Our third guest is Dr. Christian Coates Ulrichsen, PhD, and he is a Baker Institute Fellow for the Middle East, working across the disciplines of political science, international relations, and international political economy. I kicked off things with Dr. Ulrichsen, asking him about when it was, particularly, and what happened to the PIF around 2015 that brought about this transformation in its fortunes and its role that would ultimately lead to the investment in Newcastle United.
But up until 2015, it was a pretty low profile. It was focused on domestic investment. It didn't really have any international profile. And today it's described as the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia. But up until 2015, it was often said that Saudi Arabia didn't have a sovereign wealth fund. There was nothing like the equivalent, for example, of the Kuwait Investment Authority, the Qatar Investment Authority, the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, run by other Gulf countries. These were huge organizations that really were investing massively overseas, whereas a public investment fund was a much smaller scale, domestic focused investment. So they would invest in local companies in Saudi Arabia. What happened in 2015 is that Mohammed bin Salman seems to have decided that the PIF would be the vehicle that he would use to put his transformation plans into action. So in March 2015, the authority for the PIF was transferred from the Ministry of Finance to the Royal Court, which Mohammed bin Salman, as Deputy Crown Prince at the time, was part of. He's now Crown Prince. I think he was also the Royal Court Minister at the time. So he transferred authority of PIF to his oversight. And what you saw very quickly was he put Yasser al-Rumayyan in charge as governor. Al-Rumayyan had been one of Mohammed bin Salman's closest and earliest advisors. And he likes to trust a very small circle of trusted advisors, especially those who've been with him from the beginning. So he put probably his most trusted advisor in charge. In 2015, he became chairman of the board. And very quickly, the PIF suddenly began to develop an international profile for the first time, starting to invest in major international companies such as Uber, for example, but also being the vehicle. Whenever Mohammed bin Salman would announce a major project, and the Saudis call them these giga projects, like NEOM, this new city in northwestern Saudi Arabia, there's a huge entertainment complex called Qiddiya, which is being built outside Riyadh. There's massive development along the Red Sea coast. Every time Mohammed bin Salman announced a giga project, it would be then passed to PIF for implementation. And that's not just the sort of entertainment and hospitality projects. It's also, for example, Saudi Arabian military industry, which is a huge plan to turn Saudi Arabia into one of the biggest in defense industry create a massive defense industries company in Saudi Arabia to localize production of arms. And again, that was given to PIF. So every time he's made an announcement, he's turned to PIF to implement it. And so I would argue that in the Saudi Arabia of today, PIF is actually the most important part of the contemporary Saudi state, because it's not the ministries, the government ministries, that MBS Mohammed bin Salman turns to. He doesn't go to the Ministry of Finance and say, do this. He goes to PIF. And so PIF is now so closely focused with all of Mohammed bin Salman's projects, including Vision 2030, and they have their own Vision 2030 realization program within PIF, that the two are effectively inseparable.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Dr. Ulrichsen there mentioned the Newcastle United chairman and sometimes match goer at St James's Park, Yasser al-Rumayyan. I asked Neil Quilliam about Yasser al-Rumayyan, and how he came to prominence in both the PIF and where he sits in the kind of inner circle of the Saudi royal family.
I mean, he was an investment banker. He led Saudi Franci Capital. He was a successful banker in the kingdom. You know, he transformed and turned around the fortunes of that bank. And I mean, his own self-reporting really is that, you know, he was an unknown figure to MBS, but, you know, he, as happens sometimes in the kingdom, his, you know, his profile or his, you know, his CV somehow ended up on, or the, you know, bio ended up on MBS's desk. And, you know, he was invited to come in, and then basically told, this is your job. This is what you're going to do from now on. And I think, you know, the story goes, you know, he said, very well, sir, I need like 3 months, you know, I got to give 3 months notice. And it was like, no, you're going to have 1 month's notice. And then I think he got a call 3 or 4 days later saying, right, your office is ready. So in a way, you know, he's gone from being to the world at large and an unknown figure. People like myself who've been watching, you know, Saudi for a long time, you know, we tend to know who's who and who's on the circuit. And he came almost from, you know, from nowhere to absolute real prominence. I mean, he's not just governor of PIF, but I mean, he's chair of Saudi Aramco as well, you know, which is the world's largest publicly traded company in the world. And he sits on the boards of many other, you know, companies, PIF and non-PIF related companies. So he's almost come from nowhere, it seems, to being, you know, an absolute key player within the system.
So hopefully we know a little bit about the public investment fund now. So I asked Professor Simon Chadwick about sport and football in particular and what role that has played and is to play in the PIF's future.
So, I mean, the first thing I would say is I've spent time in the Gulf, a lot of time in the Gulf, and one of the things that you learn about the Gulf is that people do actually like sport there. It's not a desert, you know, when it comes to sport, and so it's somewhat disingenuous of people outside the region to be saying, well, you know, there's no culture of sport, no one's interested in sport, and it's not important. And you know, clearly, if we're talking about comparing Newcastle with Dubai or Newcastle with downtown Doha, you know, we know which is the more passionate city about sport. But if you look at somewhere like Riyadh, historically, the Riyadh Derby has always been incredibly well attended. And even now, you're talking about those top-level games in Saudi Arabia drawing 50,000, 60,000 people on a weekend basis. And we're not talking one-offs. They do this very often on a regular basis. So I think the first thing to say is that there is a culture of sport in Saudi Arabia, particularly football. People are very, very passionate about football. Certainly the Saudi Arabians I've been with, you know, their rivalries are just as bitter and just as brutal, but also just as humorous as you would find anywhere else in the world. But I don't think necessarily these countries, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Oman, Bahrain, historically they haven't had state-level sport policies or strategies. So in other words, they've not really thought about how to manage sport as countries. And so what we've seen over the last five or 10 years, possibly over the last 15 years, is a more strategic approach to sport. And by strategic approach to sport, I mean is the government thinking very carefully about the role that sport plays in economics, in politics, but also in society as well. And certainly in Saudi Arabia's case, this has culminated in this more strategic approach being adopted. We began to see that about 2015, 2016. One of the episodes at that point that really caught my attention was essentially a plan to privatize all its football clubs. So that's privatizing inverted commas, because Saudi Arabia's football clubs historically have always been bailed out by state institutions. So if they get into financial trouble, which very often they do, you know, many of Saudi Arabian football clubs, even now as we speak, have financial trouble. They have financial problems. And historically, what the government has done is just to bail them out. Now, you know, great for them. However, this doesn't motivate clubs to get better. Right? It doesn't motivate clubs to think about, well, you know, how do we control costs? How do we generate revenues? So what the Saudi Arabian government began to think about, well, is, okay, if we cut the cord between the state and the clubs so that they have to become independent, they'll then become more entrepreneurial and innovative, they'll become more efficient, they'll think about how they control their costs, how they generate revenues and so forth. Now, that is still ongoing. So the cord between the state and the clubs hasn't been cut yet. It's still ongoing. However, for instance, I talked there about enterprise, trying to promote enterprise. So one of the big agendas in Saudi Arabia right now is to promote an enterprising culture. Because what I said about, you know, when the state is there and the state is constantly backing you, you don't need to work hard. You don't need to be efficient. You don't need to think about making money, because the state will always bail you out. Now, that actually cuts across the whole of Saudi Arabian society. So there isn't this culture of, you know, setting up and running businesses. There isn't this culture of working for a business and thinking, well, you know, I'm going to make this big and successful. So what the Saudi Arabian government has been trying to do is to change the culture of the country and get people working harder, get people working independently, getting people thinking creatively, and basically cutting the cord with the state, so that, you know, what you get is, I mean, you look at the, you know, the Deloitte Annual Money League, for example. You know, you look at the top 20 or the top 30, and, you know, half of them typically are English Premier League clubs. And the reason, you know, one of the reasons for that is those clubs know that if they don't cut their cloth accordingly, the government's not going to rescue them and they're going to fall foul of financial fair play. So they're in the business of taking care of their revenues, but also trying to control costs. And this kind of commercial discipline or market discipline is one of the things that the Saudi Arabian government has been trying to achieve. And if we go back to 2018, you may recall that there was a rumor that that the Saudi Arabian government actually wanted to buy Manchester United, and that story was true. So the preference of decision makers in Riyadh is that they wanted to buy Manchester United. However, the Glazers didn't want to sell, and you know, everybody's got their price. But I think the price of the Glazers was so high that the Saudi Arabian government thought, well, you know, there are other alternatives available. And so there was the intent there to buy a club. But essentially everything went dormant. But of course, towards the end of 2019 and the early part of 2020, and I was actually sat on a plane in January 2020 about to go to the Gulf when somebody wrote to me. And said, you know, do you know that Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund is trying to buy Newcastle United? And my reaction to that, and I stayed with this for a while. My position didn't change for about 2 or 3 months afterwards. Is I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it, because if you look at everything that Saudi Arabia has been doing over the last 3 or 4 years, it is all very, very strategic. It's they have a plan. A country plan, which is going to take them to 2030 to the achievement of their national vision, or the intended achievement of their national vision. And so up until that point, it appeared to me as though Saudi Arabia didn't engage in short-term speculative investments. But I'm sure your listeners will recall, you know, kind of May 2020, the Public Investment Fund invested a lot of money, for example, in Disney. And since then, it has offloaded that holding. It sold what it bought in early 2020. And I think that led me to reconsider, especially as the stories about PIF and Newcastle began to kind of surge again in the middle of 2020.
I asked Dr. Ulrichsen about that great question, which plagued many of our lives between October 21, and that was separation between the state and the public investment fund. It's something which is still put to Newcastle fans in the minute from journalists who are less than enthusiastic about Newcastle's ownership, and it may be an issue for the club in the future. I don't know. I hope not. But from what we've heard, from what we've seen reported about certain things said by PAF to get the deal done, separation could come back to be an issue. But I asked Dr. Ulrichsen what his thoughts on the matter were.
Well, I mean, it's not an independent company. It's a sovereign. I mean, it describes itself on its own website now as a sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia. The clue there is the word sovereign. It's part of the state. It's a state-owned entity. It gets its resources from the state, and it invests in the name of the state. And of its, I think there were 8 board members, 6 of them are government ministers. The other 2 are royal court advisors, including Al Ramayan. And the chairman of the board is the Crown Prince, who is effectively the ruler in waiting, the head of state in all but name. And so it is a state entity. And I think any attempt to try and prove separation was going to be extremely challenging unless you could prove it as a legal entity that it was separate. I mean, that was probably the route, and that might have been a route that Newcastle could have gone down had that gone to an arbitration, which of course never reached that stage. I think what happened, I mean, I think the reason why they were being asked to prove separation was because the Saudi government had been implicated in the theft of Premier League broadcasting rights by an entity called BRQ. Now, BRQ seems to have been set up in Saudi Arabia in about 2017, and it was part of this whole campaign that the Saudis and the UAE had against Qatar that they announced in 2017. They were cutting diplomatic ties with Qatar. They were accusing the Qataris of all sorts of things, most of which were probably not true, but they had a big falling out with Qatar from 2017 until it was resolved in January 2021. And as part of this campaign, the Saudis, or people in Saudi Arabia, set up a company called BRQ. They called it BRQ as in Be Out Qatar. It was a play on words because the company in Qatar, which is owned by the Qatari government, called beIN Sports, they acquired the broadcasting rights for the Premier League in the Middle East. And so here you had a situation from 2017 onwards where the Premier League's broadcasting rights in the biggest market in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, were being pirated. And in 2020, there was a World Trade Organization ruling which basically said they were operating within Saudi Arabia. There were entities and individuals within Saudi Arabia who were behind it, and the Saudi state either didn't do anything or were unable to prevent it. And so that established a link between the Saudi government and this BRQ organization, which had been basically bootlegging the Premier League's broadcasting rights. And so for that same Saudi state then to control a Premier League football team was, I think, where the issue lay. Would they have passed the owner and directors test if they were proven to have been implicated in the theft of broadcasting rights? And so I think that's where the issue was. It kind of got stuck all that time in 2020 and 2021. What changed in October 2021? The announcement that BN had its access restored in Saudi Arabia was followed 24 hours later by the announcement that the takeover had been approved. I mean, in my view, that was the stumbling block, and the fact that the approval came 24 hours after the Saudis finally restored BN's access to Saudi Arabia is effectively, I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence. And of course, it unblocked the entire process. And the Premier League announced that it had received legally binding assurances, which they haven't really said what they are. But I just think that the issue all along was the fact that the Premier League's broadcasting rights were being infringed, and the Saudi state was implicated, if not completely directly involved. And so I think that's what happened there. And what I think happened in 2017, the Saudi, there were elements in Saudi Arabia, possibly including people around the Crown Prince, who were looking at ways to kind of poke the Qataris to, and someone thought, okay, we'll do this. We'll set up a fake television station. We'll call it BRQ. We'll nick all their rights. But they weren't really thinking, okay, but what happens in 3 years if we want to buy a football team in the Premier League? I mean, there wasn't that sort of joined up thinking. You know, it seemed like a good idea in 2017 to just sort of get one up on Qatar. But then, of course, it had consequences. And it had consequences in 2020 when the Saudi state, or at least elements of the Saudi state in the PIF, thought that they'd quite like to buy a Premier League football team. And so the fact that it was resolved, and then within 24 hours the takeover took place, you know, in my view, they were linked all along.
I then asked Neil Quilliam about how things have been in Saudi Arabia for both the public and the PIF since the acquisition of the club in October 2021.
Very well known, it's widely known that that PIF has invested in Newcastle. And I think the last time we spoke, I said, you know, if that happens, then you're going to suddenly have nearly a whole country's worth of supporters. That speaks volumes also to, you know, to the Premier League. I've been going in and out of the region for a very long time, and I used to go to the Palestinian territories when I was a much younger man, and those were the days when Liverpool, you know, were I suppose they are now, but, you know, they're really flying high, and young children would just come up to me. The only words they could speak would be Liverpool or Man United. You know, this is the Premier League. This is the kind of language and the currency. So I think the purchase has been massively popular, and it's widely well known. If you speak to sort of Saudis sort of within the, say, the political or within the business establishment, they would say to you, you know, this is, you know, this, we have our own reasons for making this purchase, and if Newcastle doesn't, you know, go and win the Champions League, you know, we're not going to lose any sleep over that. That wasn't the simple reason for, you know, doing so. But I'm sure that they will want success. I mean, they've seen their neighbors, you know, investing in other clubs that have done, you know, very well. So I think sort of whether you see that as healthy competition or whatever it might be, I think there'll be a real drive to want Newcastle to do, you know, extremely well. But that isn't going to be like we want them to win the Premier League this coming season. I think, you know, there's recognition that it's going to need a long-term investment and a build-up towards that. But I would have said, you know, I mean, these guys set visions out to 2030. They've set visions out to 2050. I haven't heard any sort of vision time on this, but I imagine somewhere in their mind they're thinking, you know, this is a goal to which, you know, we're working from. And I think, you know, the idea that, you know, Newcastle being, you know, being what it is as a football club and having its long history, that's something that, you know, they would very much cherish in going forward. So if you're, you know, if you're sort of bouncing around, great to bounce around the middle at the moment, but if you're bouncing around the middle in, you know, 6 or 7 years' time, I suspect they want to put some, you know, some heat under somebody's feet to lift that up into the top six.
Very exciting answer from Neil there. Now we've discussed, or you've heard about, the impact of the purchase of Newcastle United in Saudi Arabia and potential plans for the future. I asked Professor Chadwick to talk about another accusation, often put unfairly in my view, but that Newcastle United fans are engaged in sports washing, or that the sole purpose of the purchase of the football club is sports washing or massaging of a country's PR. Here's Simon's very interesting answer.
I revisit again what I've said several times already, which is that I've been in the Gulf lots of times. I don't know, 50, 60, 70 times. And I've been in lots of meetings with lots of people. You know, I've met taxi drivers and construction workers, and I've met senior government officials and sponsors, and people who run football clubs. And not once have I heard anybody talk about sport washing. So I think the characterization of what Saudi Arabia has done, and for that matter, what Qatar has done, what China has done, what Russia has done, what Britain does, what the United States has done, you know, I think that characterization is a very Western characterization of country activity. I don't think it. I'm not going to say I disagree with it or think it's wrong. I think the phrase sport washing has merit. And if you look at some of the things that, for instance, you go back to 19, you go back to the British Empire, you know, we sport washed. You know, the British used sport to sport wash. We didn't call it sport washing back then, but it was sport washing. You know, you go through to 1936 and the Olympics and Adolf Hitler, that's sport washing. 1978 World Cup in Argentina. What we know is that the military junta was bribing rival teams to let Argentina win because it was going to make the country look better than it actually was. You know, the junta was under pressure from dissidents. You know, that potentially was sport washing as well. So I think using sport to influence perceptions and attitudes and behaviors towards a country is nothing new. The characterization of it as sport washing is new. And so what we've got is we've had rights groups, we've had Amnesty International and others using this term sport washing to draw attention to human rights abuses. And I think that there are issues that need to be addressed in countries like Saudi Arabia. But I think to exclusively characterize what Saudi Arabia is doing as sport washing is a gross oversimplification. And I very often say to people, you know, one person's sport washing is another person's soft power. And soft power is attractive power. So countries use soft power so that we're attracted to them, because if we're attracted to countries, we're more likely to cut business deals with them. We're more likely to go on holiday there. When it comes to military campaigns, we're more likely to trust them. And so what Saudi Arabia is also trying to do is to use football as one example, as an instrument of soft power, because what essentially soft power is all about is trying to demonstrate to others that you want the same things as they do, that you value the same things. And I can tell you, as somebody who travels the world, I always use Brazil as an example. I always say to my students, you know, when you think about Brazil, what do you think? And you know, I ask the same question to your listeners. When you think about Brazil, what do you think? Well, you know, you think about fantastic footballers, Mirandinha, if I remember rightly, going back to the 1980s. You know, you remember fantastic football. You know, sexy football, beaches, and that's the stereotype that many of us have about Brazil, and that's been built up through Brazil projecting this image of itself as being, you know, kind of a hotbed of football. If you ask people, what do you think about Saudi Arabia? Well, you know, what we think about Saudi Arabia is executions and human rights abuses, and Saudi Arabia wants to change that narrative. It wants to change the perceptions that people around the world have of the country, and as somebody who knows quite a few Saudi Arabians, they're very nice people. They've got a great sense of humor. They're really hospitable. You know, they really do take care of you when you're with them. And yet we don't see that. What we see is, I mean, we see all the negative stuff. And so I think this investment in football is part of this soft power projection, because the Saudi Arabian government wants us to have positive associations, not negative associations. So some people might call it soft power, but I guess some people might alternatively refer to it as sport washing.
Fascinating answer there from Professor Simon Chadwick there on the issue of alleged sports washing. Totally different way of thinking about it, and I'm so pleased that you came on the show to articulate it. I'm going to finish off now on this podcast. I hope it's been interesting to everyone. I learned so much speaking to these guys. It's so interesting. I'm so grateful to them for their time. I'm going to finish off. I asked Dr. Christian Ulrichsen about a topic which I've tried to look into a little bit. It's hard out there to find, well, certainly, I probably think as good a description as Dr. Ulrichsen provided me. But it's a topic that the detractors of the takeover, people who don't like the ownership of Newcastle United, some quite prominent people on social media, on the written press, talk about often when talking about Newcastle United these days, and that is the ongoing civil conflict in Yemen. I asked Dr. Ulrichsen to essentially give me an overview of what happened, why it happened, and what is happening now. So I'll leave you with that if you're interested. I found it a fascinating answer. Grateful to all three of our guests for their time, giving up their time to speak to you, the listeners of the True Faith podcast. Hope the podcast's been informative. This is the off season. We're trying to do things differently at True Faith and provide you with some different content. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Like I said at the start, all three of our guests, full interviews with me on our Patreon platform for £6.60 a month. I'll leave you with the excellent and informative answer of Dr. Ulrichsen. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Well, the Saudi-led coalition, led by the Saudi government, went into Yemen in March 2015, so 2 months after Salman became king, 2 months after he appointed Mohammed bin Salman as Minister of Defence. And so this was really Mohammed bin Salman's first big decision as Minister of Defence, was to effectively intervene in Yemen's conflict. Yemen has been undergoing a period of turmoil since the Arab Spring in 2011, which led to the ousting of its leader for more than 30 years, President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had managed to sort of play different groups off for 30 years and have a very fragile, uneasy kind of game of balancing different competing interests in Yemen. And after he was removed, what you saw was a movement in northern Yemen along the Saudi border, the Houthi movement, in 2014. They actually allied themselves with the ousted president to then go south and capture the capital, Sana'a. And the Saudis were convinced that the Houthis were, because they're an offshoot of Shia Islam, they're not the same branch as Iran, but they have, in Saudi eyes, been given support by Iran. To some extent, that's become a self-fulfilling prophecy. As the war has gone on, as factions on the ground have radicalized, that support has become more visible. But in 2014, when the Houthis captured the capital, the Saudis felt like they were being surrounded by Iran, by Iran's regional supporters. They saw, for example, in Damascus, the Assad regime having been given Iranian support. They saw in Iraq after 2003, Iran becoming a major player in Iraqi politics. The Saudis were convinced, even though there was no direct evidence, that in Bahrain, the Iranians played a role in the 2011 protests. And so from a Saudi point of view, they saw themselves as surrounded by Iranian influence, which in their view is Shia influence, and the Saudis are the leaders of Sunni Islam. And they saw themselves surrounded by groups which were hostile, were radical, and were, in their view, answering to Tehran, to Iran. So the Saudis felt that they were going to do something about it. This was also the same time that the US and other Western powers, plus Russia and China, were negotiating with Iran for the Iran nuclear deal, which was passed in 2015. And this was the Saudis' way of effectively telling the US and others, fine, if you want to deal with Iran on a nuclear issue, you can. But for us, the threat from Iran is their regional destabilization. So if you're not going to take action, we will. And so they went into Yemen at the head of a coalition with the UAE and I think about 8 or 9 other Arab states. And so that's how they see it. They see it as they're trying to restore political order. They're trying to push back Iranian influence. The challenge, I think, for the Saudis is that they called the operation Operation Decisive Storm. It hasn't been decisive. It's been now more than 7 years. They still haven't achieved any of their political or military objectives in the sense that the Houthis remain in control, not only of the capital, but of large areas of central and northern Yemen. Iran's support has increased to the Houthis. the conflict has generated multiple sub-conflicts, and the Saudis can't figure out a way of extricating themselves in a way that doesn't make it look like they've lost. So I think that's where they are. And it has created a lot of reputational damage to the Saudis on the international stage, just because bombing from the air with airstrikes creates impressions that the Saudis don't necessarily care enough about targeting, about who they target, what they hit. You know, there have been instances of schools being bombed, of mosques being bombed. There's been a lot of civilian casualties on the ground. And also after 2018, when there was a spotlight on Saudi human rights issues with the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, there was a lot of congressional pressure from both Republicans and Democrats on Saudi Arabia, and again using Yemen as well as sort of even more evidence that, as you said, in sort of their words, the Saudis are the bad guys in this conflict. And so that's where we are today. We're 7 years in. The Saudis still, they can't win, but they don't quite know how to get out without looking like they've lost. And of course, Yemen is now a failed state. It's a humanitarian catastrophe. There's famine in parts of Yemen. Obviously, with COVID, it's been a huge problem. And so we're kind of stuck, and that's where we are.